you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to the Phantom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachrin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudet, who is an editor at Contently. I almost nailed it. You know what? You were like pointing at the screen, and I was trying to figure out...
Oh, I was trying to communicate something to you non-verbally.
Yeah, and I couldn't figure out what you were... Couldn't figure out what you were trying to communicate, and honestly... The rest of the intro came out of my mouth like it was muscle memory.
I believe
it. I was like, wait, it's coming to my mouth. I don't even know how this happened. I'm not thinking about it.
Of course it's muscle
memory. Yeah. So it's been like almost a year of me just saying that incessantly. And like 14 times per podcast.
Yeah.
So what were you trying to communicate to me?
I was wondering to myself, did you write this intro comment for me? I was like, this is not. Oh, you must have moved it up. Okay, well...
So this is what happened. So we were going to do a podcast with last week, and it didn't happen. Schedule mishap. So we kind of, I don't think we're really scripted. We're pretty, we're definitely not scripted if you listen. Our longtime fans know that. But, you know, we tried to keep some notes, and Emily was pointing at, like, where do these notes come from? Did you write this for me?
They're so old at this point that I completely forgot.
Why don't you read them? Please read them just verbatim.
Okay. Just with no intro at all. Cam and I committed to doing stuff around the house over the weekend, and we put Sci-Fi's Harry Potter marathon on while cleaning and fixing shit. I had forgotten so much about the movie series, especially how Zack Snyder-y it got in the last three movies. They're always fighting in dark CGI environments, and everyone's miserable or dead. Anyway, what's the geekiest thing you did recently? I must have written that down, like, that'll be my banter.
Everything is miserable. Yeah, those movies were not fun, buddy. I mean, look, sci-fi...
They were moving.
Yeah, they were good. They were not really particularly fun,
I kept saying as we were watching it, I was like, wow, what a savvy marketing play to buy the
re-airing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal for sci-fi.
Because we sat through every one.
Yeah. I think like that's a bulk of the weekend programming.
That's smart as hell. Because like it was a day where we were like, all right, we're going to be in the house all day. Hmm. You're not going to clean in silence. So we put on Harry Potter, and it was like all I thought about for 48 hours was Harry Potter.
Julia's still never seen any of them. That's impressive at this point. Like, yeah.
She said,
you'd appreciate this. She was like, look, Lord of the Rings was coming out at the same time, and I had to make a decision. Like, I had read Lord of the Rings books, and I liked them. So I was like, I'm not going to do two epic fantasy series. Because I guess when she was in high school, she had a lot going on.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, unlike me.
I have a social life.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she did
fair.
Like sports, and she had a life. Sure. And so I was like, bring it on.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of geeky, after watching those movies, I was like, I have a hunger for Harry Potter. And I like downloaded the phone game. And I was doing that for like a day. And then Cam looked over my shoulder and he was like, that's a children's game. And I was like, oh, it is.
Speaking of adults obsessing over children's things,
yeah,
we got to talk about this creepy obsession with Noah Centineo.
Is that his name?
Yes.
How you say it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been like angry about this in silence.
We've been fulminating about this over GChat for like the last few weeks.
Oh my God.
People are obsessed with, all right, so the fantasy is that this kid who's 22 years old, but he plays a high schooler in that To All the Boys I Loved Before Netflix movie.
Not only a high schooler, but in both movies I've seen him in, he plays like a, whoa, I'm a jock high schooler. Like, he's not like a Timothy Chalamet is my point.
But regardless, like grown women are sweating him, being thirsty for him hard on the internet.
Oh my God,
And you sent this to me, this article from The Cut, that they went, the writer, who's significantly older than him, just by virtue of being a senior writer at The Cut.
I think so.
Yeah, she used to work at The Ringer. And it's a well-written story, but she went to Coney Island with Noah Centineo and like had, in the opening of the story, like she's requesting that he do a thing from the movie in which he's like touching her ass.
Yeah, he puts his hand in her back pocket.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, like, it made me uncomfortable.
Yeah,
he's an interview subject, and he's new to this, so he's got to, like, just go along with it, I guess.
There's multiple layers of weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I tried, because you and I have both interviewed subjects for a while, yeah. a little while, you twice as long as me. And it safe to assume that we have been attracted to people that we've interviewed in the past. But I was trying to imagine a scenario where I would be like, please touch my body, interview yeah. subject. What the fuck?
I mean, there's so many movies that have like sex scenes or yeah. have like action, like, you know, close encounters. And like, if I was like, hey, let's recreate that sex scene you did, it would be like, what? Or just like,
hell?
I don't even touch the interview subject. Like, why would I need to? I spent days with interview subjects that like at Sundance or wherever.
Yeah.
And I've never felt the need or even was like faking the need to have any sort of physical contact.
Yeah. For me, it's so multi-layered. So like that added a whole other layer. We were already like concerned.
Yeah, it's weird that people are
before that happened.
Thirsting over this guy who is the fantasy is that he's a high schooler.
Right. He is 20, right?
22.
Okay, 22. So still, I'm a 28-year-old woman. If I were dating a 22-year-old man, I would hope that my friends would be like, what's going on,
there's
man?
People
that's weird.
Who are like in their mid to like 30s that are like, oh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's strange as hell.
And that's the thing. I'm not going to police who you're attracted to as long as there's it's like victimless. But performing your
yeah.
attracted energy on social media is like, what?
I mean, because it's like a, like, there's a weird, it's this weird line because people strangely are like, oh, but I love his character. I'm like, but his character's in high school. So you can't even get away with it saying like, oh, it's just a fictional like crush. I'm like, yeah, and it, fictionally it's even worse.
Right. Yeah. And I guess like there's another layer of it to me because so my boy, that was Freudian. My brother, not my boyfriend, my brother is 14. Creepy. See, this is what I'm saying. It's creepy.
Yeah.
Brother's 14. He's often like carrying himself the way that this character does
sure.
in both movies where he's just like, I don't know anything. You're cute. Like, I cannot wrap my mind around an adult woman watching that and thinking, oh, like imagining herself in the protagonist's spot. Like at right. this point, you should kind of, you should be looking at the dad, you know?
Well, even my brother's 23. And so
yeah, okay.
I'm 9 years older than him. And so, you know, this guy's 22 in real life. If I was to make like a pass at one of his like friends,
his
girls,
contemporaries,
like I would hope he'd punch me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
That's like creepy older brother type deal.
Yeah.
It's weird because I don't want to like, it's tough because, you know, I don't want to be like, well, guys can't do it because men have been doing horrible things for so long that women have had to deal with. So it's not
yes.
that. It's just the age difference in general. This is still like a kid. He's a kid, basically.
Yeah. And I actually, I have a specific friend. I'm not going to like point her out, but she does a bit in her stand up where she's like, I am concerned that I have not grown past like cute boys.
Mm.
She's my age. You know, we can like credit her comedy if she doesn't mind. But she's like, you know, I'm still attracted to the archetype that I was when I was like 14.
Right.
And I assume that I wouldn't be into like skateboarder anymore, but I am. But she's like contending with this publicly. It's like part of her art and
she's
she
not
jokes
proud
about
of it.
It. Yeah, that's the thing. She feels like this is weird. So now on the flip side, I see all like a majority of the women in my life. People begged me to watch this movie. And I'm not saying like, okay, clearly it wasn't for me. Like, that's fine. It's not a genre I like love. But also I couldn't get through it because just the idea that people were like, sit down, it's amazing. He's so cute. I felt like a creep.
It reminds you that like no matter how much people grow, they still just harbor the same fantasies.
Yeah.
From when they were a kid.
Yeah. And like, of course we all have a type, but my type is not.
I love Rob Delaney on Twitter. He's like, I like real women. Like
yeah.
real women in their 30s.
Yes.
We talk about Rob Delaney more and more every single day.
That's true.
He tweets and it's almost like a race to like text it to the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're now obsessed with his family tree.
Well, in our defense, that one time he was like, I'd love to come on Fandom Files.
Right?
And I think we both took it as permission to just like constantly read what he writes.
He was like, sure, I would love to. I mean, look, maybe Rob's a huge fan. Maybe he's giving yeah. us 5-star reviews.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Right? Who knows? That'd be fantastic.
I mean, look, everyone knows we need 5-star reviews.
Yeah.
If Rob Delaney came on, we'd at least get a couple.
Yeah, it's true.
What's amazing to me is the sheer number of people that listen to the podcast versus the numbers that like refuse to give it reviews.
Oh, yeah. Plus, everyone in my social circle is like, no, I don't listen. They don't even apologize. I know. And that's how I know no one's going to get mad about this Noah thing.
Well, who was it? You know, our friend Sarah from Inverse just posted some video. I don't say some video. She just did this whole big thing where she went abroad.
Oh, Peru?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Incredible. Yeah.
And so I saw it on Facebook, and I intend on going back to watch it, but I don't know if that's out of... I mean, she's great, so I don't know if it's out of guilt that I'm going to go watch it, because it's so hard to watch all your friends' creative stuff and read all the articles.
You also know, you are friends with a lot of like creators and filmmakers too.
Yeah, I mean, like I had friends who were making short films and they sucked, but I'd just be like, yeah, that's good.
That's my relationship with anyone who covers what is up with me? Science and tech, because I don't search for that stuff on my own. That's right. Like not a part of my media diet, but I do keep up with people because I know them and I want them to have reads.
I wonder what percentage of, if I tweet an article out or even put it on Facebook, like what percentage of my friends see it and what percentage of those friends actually click on it.
I will admit that I read what you directly send
sure.
me.
Right. I wouldn't, I mean, I
don't know how often
to.
I like look at your, I never am like Jordan Zegger and stuff. I like to look up your
sure.
new articles,
no, I mean, I wouldn't
know?
Expect anyone to.
Yeah.
It's more just curiosity. Like, am I just like tweeting into the void?
Yeah. My own boyfriend said, I don't really listen to podcasts. And then he was doing his final fantasy. No, his fantasy basketball.
You're all fucked up today.
His final fantasy basketball thing. And he was listening to a podcast to get information about it. I was like, wow, he lied.
So full of shit.
Anyway.
Well, you know, what is a geek? You know, I did not talk about the geekiest thing I did this week.
Yeah.
We got off topic.
What is it?
One, I was watching elections, right? The mm-hmm. huge elections in New York. We don't want to get political because we don't get good reviews when we do that. Actually, our episode next week is going to be all political.
Explicitly political.
Explicitly. Like sex politics.
No one wants that.
Newt Gingrich. God. So this week, I'm not going to talk about politics now, but I've been deep into the Disney Afternoon lore, like DuckTales, okay. Tailspin, Darkwing Ducks. I'm doing an oral history on it.
Phrasing, but okay.
Deep into Disney Afternoon lore.
You were like, deep, I've been like, deep. All right.
Yeah. So I've been like watching some DuckTales episodes, Darkwing Duck episodes, and just working on this oral history. And I talked to the guy who's done, like, he does voices for everyone, like, from Winnie the Pooh and Tigger to, like, half the cartoon characters you ever watch.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Jim Cummings, and I said to him, I was talking to him about Darkwing Duck, because it was the first character he, like, originated himself. I said, you know, I was watching the first, I'm like a 32-year-old guy talking about Darkwing Duck, so... anyways,
do you just have a moment of clarity? Like, here I am.
No, I have so many moments of clarity when it comes to this stuff. But I was watching Darkwing Duck, and I realized this, and I said it to him. You know, Darkwing Duck, he's this guy, this dude who lives on a bridge alone and decides to fight crime, and he seems like kind of a sociopath, right? And he was like, this whole time, this guy's like making voices and laughing in the conversation, and then the second I said, he seems like kind of a sociopath, right? He's like, no, I didn't see it that way. And I was oh, God, I did not.
He, like, personally identified with Darkwing Duck.
He was protective of Darkwing.
Also, so. I have to assume it's, like, a Batman parody, right?
Yes. I mean, it started as kind of a James Bond parody, and then they couldn't keep the... So, I guess 007 is owned by the Broccoli family, and, like, any variation thereof. Isn't it great that James Bond's owned by the Broccolis?
Yeah, I've never heard that.
Yeah.
Cool.
So any variation thereof. So they couldn't do 00 Duck, which they originally wanted it to be.
Oh.
So then it morphed over time to become like a Silver Age detective, Batman-y, green, whatever type character.
Huh. All I remember is the sound, Darkwing Duck, and like him holding his cape over his mouth like a vampire.
And then it's like, let's get dangerous.
Yes, that's okay. Yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah, so I've been like living with this.
I'm sure you will send me this thing directly and I will read it.
The amount of effort that's going to go into it is patently absurd. The amount of number of hours. Yeah.
You do go deep into reporting.
Yeah, I mean, I just did a oral history of Sharknado. It was
great.
10,000 words. Thank you. That was absurd. So this is even more absurd because it's so many shows and there's only so much to say. Like, should I have an entire like 800 words about the show Gummy Bears? It feels weird, but they told me about it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I will say the oral history is probably the only format of reporting that makes me go like, ooh, when I see one that
like,
I want.
Like the Frasier one?
Like the Frasier one, yeah, it was so good. Oh, man, that was like a platonic ideal of an oral history.
I really liked the Step Brothers one on The Ringer a few months ago.
Okay, I have an admission. I've never seen Step Brothers.
Oh,
I know. Cam does the exact same thing.
He goes, oh.
Yeah, he does.
Oh. Like someone just shot him.
Like I punched him in the gut.
You got to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even say that about most movies.
That's true. You don't.
I saw Searching last weekend.
Yeah, I saw it a couple weekends ago.
Yeah, but that movie I was really hooked into. Most movies, my mind wanders. I'm like, all right, what am I gonna eat for dinner tonight? Like, what kind of work do I have to do?
Yeah, they kept getting me.
Yeah.
On every plot turn, I was like, oh.
Except for
like,
the brother.
Whoa. Yeah. And I got goosebumps. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, I guess.
I'll just say that, like, A, I want to see the editing timeline because it's all, for those that are listening but don't know about the movie Searching, which you have a very weird media diet if that's the case. You're listening to us but don't know about Searching. It's all on computer screens and cell phone screens.
Yeah.
So I want to see the editing timeline because everything is so well put together.
And I didn't think it was hacky at all.
No.
At no point was I like, boy, I wish they would cut to a real... Though we did say there's a shot where, like, an actual crime scene investigation's happening and like the local news is just filming it live. Yeah. We were like, I don't think they'd be allowed.
There's a bit of a cheat where he has like his iMessage, iMessage video open on his computer all the time.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
So like he's just an exhibitionist.
Perhaps.
But he's like, I don't care about the NSA. Screw it.
Also, if my father were FaceTiming me that often, what the hell?
Yeah. That'd be the worst. I'd be like, Dad, please, no. I mean, it's a really close relationship, father and daughter. Bond.
Do you think your dad listens to this?
I don't know. No.
He certainly reads both our Twitter feeds.
I don't know if he listens. No, I don't think so. I don't. I think he'd say something.
Yeah. My dad... This made no sense. Possibly his hearing is going, but he tried a couple episodes and he was like, I can never tell who's talking.
Right, yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure.
That's a big problem between us. Like, both the content of what we say and our voices sound exactly alike.
Identical.
Yeah, you sound like a squeaky, like, New Jersey person.
And you sound like a stoner teenage boy.
Yep. All right. Well, Emily, why don't you tell us about... we have a guest.
We
do. By the way, we have a guest today.
Okay, so our guest today is Erica Clash, a New York City drag queen who you may know as a former contestant on the Boulay Brothers web series Dragula. She finished 6th on season 2 and went on to tour the country as a performer who appeals to gamers, anime fans, drag fans, animation nerds, and people who like a little bit of horror in their drag. She also recently performed at a FlameCon party in Times Square, which is how we found her.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. We've been hoping to have a drag performer on for a long time, and we couldn't believe that you were into all the stuff we're into. So.
Yeah, it was perfect. We were at that party, and then we were like, oh my God, this is could not be better.
Well, that's the magic of FlameCon, is that as a nerdy performer, I get to sort of meet the people that, you know, would appreciate what I do, and that's why I've always been a fan of FlameCon.
If you don't mind, what we do when we have someone on the show is we start with their origin story. Can you tell us were you into geeky media first or drag first?
Definitely geeky media. I mean, I grew up, you know, playing Super Mario Brothers with my sisters but really loving it and playing Pokemon and Zelda. And so I was a big video game nerd growing up. And so that was really how it started. And then, you know, as I came out and went to college and got to understand, and especially through Drag Race, getting to understand what drag was all about, I said, wow, you know, this is the art form for me.
Mm.
So when that happened, when you started combining them, were people in drag skeptical?
I don't know about skeptical necessarily, but I think that they were not sure what to think of it. I mean, there wasn't really, it's not like I'm the first person to ever do this, but I was the first person to sort of, or one of the major people to sort of make a shtick, a real fully realized character and shtick out of it. So I think, you know, being in a place like New York City where a lot of the drag that you see dominating sort of the Manhattan scene, it's very fishy Broadway. They're working on a whole other set of source materials there. I think at some point, you know, they didn't know quite what to think, but... eventually I earned their respect and learned a lot from them.
Where did you you start doing drag and you create this character. Where did you start performing? How did you like get to the point where you ended up on Dragula?
Yeah, well, it really started off, you know, with doing amateur competitions and meeting people that way. And then I was, you know, sort of gigging regularly in New York City, steadily up until the end of, or the beginning of 2017, when I moved to San Francisco with my partner. And that, you know, learning from the San Francisco scene and all of that, and also being closer to Los Angeles, that was really what enabled me to do Dragula. But it really starts out with people just believing in you enough to give you an opportunity to perform and to hone your craft. And I just kept, I also did a lot of sort of self-produced content. So it wasn't necessarily me documenting my looks for gigs because, you know, I wanted to pull up all these avant-garde interesting looks. So, you know, whenever gigs got slow in New York City or I felt like I wasn't fully being understood, I just went on off to my own side and of things and created my art and shared it with the world on social media. So social media was a big part of how I built a career also.
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to ask you, what has your relationship with fans been like online? Is that crazy, like having to talk to people all the time?
Yeah, it's very crazy. I think it's taught me to value private time also. but I think one of the really exciting things, I see myself inspiring other people, you know, changing how people look at drag and, you know, to have your own unique point of view as an artist and to sort of so honestly express that and to have people respond is really, really, it's really awesome. So, you know, I really, really, really do value the fans and I really do try to go the extra mile and interact with them. Because that's what they look for in us. They look for community leaders just as much as they look look for artists.
So creating the character, how did that all come together? Where did the name, from the name America Clash to the inspirations that, you know, obviously it's, you know, anime and nerd stuff that inspired it, but the particulars of building the character I'm very interested in.
Yeah, and the character has evolved a lot, by the way, over time. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I started off loving video games and wanted to really incorporate that very strongly in my drag. So that was sort of the basis of the character, which was sort of a Princess Peach sort of character, damsel dress, but with a twist to it, of course, a draggy twist. And that sort of, you know, grew into me doing a lot of cosplay. Then that itself grew into me doing a lot of fantasy makeup looks. And then I really found myself looking for my own sort of signature style outside of just cosplay. Because, by the way, you don't have to do cosplay to be a nerdy performer necessarily or a sort of underground performer, you know, somebody who, you know, you can pull references from a lot of different places. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to sort of develop my own style. So then I started taking the sort of my favorite elements, the countercultural elements of drag, you know, things like the Trinimal movement, similar things, and sort of applying that to the sort of transgressive nature of Japanese street fashion, you know. Mm-hmm. The Golden Harajuku, they're doing something really, really countercultural. Even when you look at something like Gangoro, which is about reclaiming darker skin in a society that favors pale skin, you know. It is punk rock, you know, by another name, if you ask me. So that was kind of where that sort of started to develop. And now I'm embracing, you know, my lifelong love of horror. And so it's a really exciting time.
You know, it's funny you mentioned cosplay because there's, you know, in some ways you think drag and nerdy stuff don't really cross over much, but then cosplay kind of is like the great equalizer, but the thing that kind of brings them together.
The connector, sure.
Yeah. Well, I've talked about cosplay before as sort of something that grew out of the celebrity impersonation tradition in drag. Mm. You know, you look at a Chad Michaels or a Frank Marino, mm-hmm. they have so much reverence and admiration for Cher, Joan Rivers, Britney Spears, you know. And so I think of this as, like, I have such admiration for a character like Sailor Neptune that I want to embody her mm-hmm. in the same way that Chad Michaels would want to embody Cher. So I don't think it's incompatible with drag. I don't think it's really that different of a thing. It is character illusion.
That's interesting that you say Sailor Scouts. That Sailor Moon comes up a lot when we talk to queer artists. What do you think the connection is there, or why is it important to you?
You know, I think Sailor Moon, in many ways, very relatable. Or rather, Serena Usagi is very relatable. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Sailor Moon. You know, Usagi goes from this outsider because of who she is, meaning because she's Sailor Moon. She's on a different journey than the people around her, oftentimes, and yet that journey gives her so much power, right? she's saving the world, but, you know, she's also sacrificing the normal things that a teenage girl gets to experience. So I think it's that sense of facing adversity, dealing with sort of difficult backgrounds or different difficult parts of yourself. I think that's something that, not just Sailor Moon, but Wonder Woman, all kinds of gay icons, even, you know, the Judy Garlands and the, you know, the Joan Crawfords, the people who, those powerful feminine figures who have been through so much adversity, I think that's really why queer people identify with them, because the struggle is similar, of being an outsider, but then, you know, having power through being an outsider, you know, what makes us different makes us stronger, I think, sometimes, and I think that's kind of what inspires people about Sailor Moon.
We talked a little bit about the drag world's reception of you as a performer, but what has been your experience in sort of like mainstream geeky spaces? Have you gone to cons other than FlameCon?
I've been to New York Comic Con, and I think because people there were not given any context to me, and because I present very feminine, even out of drag, I think people are not even sure that I was a drag queen. I tend to not go to conventions all the time, just because they're very, very hard on the body, you know, being in heels that long without a dressing room, all that kind of stuff. Never been particularly what I love to do. What I love more than anything is performing and the nightclub experience. But I think, you know, there's definitely overlap between people just appreciating the reference, right? And if you can be creative with character, you know, for example, I like to take a lot of non-human characters and sort of apply this sort of non-human shape to the human body. I think that trans drag or anything, it's just about finding a creative way to transform yourself into something. And I cosplayers do stuff like that all the time, and that's really the kind of cosplay that gets me excited.
At this point, are you touring full-time?
Mostly full-time. So Dragula has been great for that. It's really amazing that I get to travel. But I also work front of house at Yerba Buena Art Center in downtown San Francisco. And that was a great way for me to kind of make some extra cash and build some experience doing front of house and sort of working behind the scenes on shows. Because I think the more skills you can learn, the better. And a lot of these sort of logistical skills really help me when producing events also.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, it's the artwork you do is incredible and it takes so much effort, but this is the ultimate question for so many artists, like, how do you make that a sustainable life? And obviously you mentioned you work front of house. Like, do you see this as, you know, not even in terms of, like, what are your long-term plans, but this not only like an art, but also business?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a struggle every day, not a struggle, but it's a challenge and a sort of a process every day of sort of looking at the numbers, you know, for anybody who's making a career out of this, a living out of this, you have to keep track of your numbers, and you also have to be, you know, kind to yourself as far as, you know, just not overdoing it as far as, you know, spending on your drug and all that. But, you know, really, I find that my creativity is really unlocked when I can ask myself, how cheaply can I do something? Or I guess not cheap because that's a negative connotation, but how economically can I do something? Mm-hmm. How much creativity can I pour into this, such that it doesn't really matter how much I spend on it because it's a piece of art that I made as opposed to something that I purchased. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does. Absolutely.
So that's sort of been the thrill recently, you know, especially moving to San Francisco, like learning how to sew and all of that. It's really exciting to have just a bunch of raw materials and repurpose it all into something that looks great but didn't cost that much.
How is San Francisco's drag scene different than New York?
I would say, you know, New York, it can be a little bit cliquish and divided at some points. I think there's a lessening, I hope, but a sort of definite divide between like the Brooklyn and Manhattan scenes in New York. And I think there are certain types of drag that work really well in New York and others that aren't seen as much.
Sure.
And I think in San Francisco, everybody's very community oriented and everybody's very supportive of, you know, sort of alternative types of drag. The Boulets have said many times that Trying Shack, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s, that was a big inspiration for Dragula. And San Francisco has a long history of being inclusive to women that do drag, other kinds of non-traditional, whatever that means, non-traditional drag performers. So I think whereas New York is more of that Broadway, the girls in New York City know how to entertain.
Right.
You know, they do shows by themselves for 2 hours. So you need to have a lot of tricks in your bag. You need to have a really wide library of songs that you love to do and just be able to also improvise and perform on the fly.
So, you know, you talk about, you know, all these different inspirations. Like, what are you working on now? Like, what are the kind of, whether it's costumes or performances, like, which nerdy things are you bringing into your performances right now?
Yeah, let me see what's in the pipeline here. I have a bunch of sort of projects in the backlog. Right now what I'm working on is the next two entries in the Pastel Gore series, which, if you don't know about that, Pastel Gore is my show here in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. In order to do promo for that show, we each pick a pastel color and we create a punk drag look with that color. So it's sort of a monochromatic series of looks. Right now I'm working on yellow and peach for the last two.
Can you describe Pastel Gore a little more? Like, what can people expect if they're going?
Yeah, it's like murdering a Lisa Frank unicorn.
Yeah, so Pastel Gore is really, it's the Bay Area's like nerdy punk drag show.
Wow.
I co-produce it with Cash Monet, and then in the core cast, you know, the two of us, and we have to have Rock'em Sakura, Kai Kaizi Michael. These are performers that I've always really respected ever since I moved to the Bay Area and got to work with them for the first time. Mm-hmm. They're all nerdy performers. They're all embodying that sort of Bay Area punk drag performance style. And I think our styles gel well, very well together without us sort of being restrictive in terms of like what we perform, how we perform it. We did our first few shows at the Stud, and for each show we have a theme. So the first show was Ghost Type Pokemon.
Cool.
We did Dance Dance Revolution. We've done a Studio Ghibli show. We produced our first few shows at the Stud in San Francisco. And then now we've sort of been invading other shows in the Bay Area. We just did a show in Oakland last month. We were just at in the Castro doing a fighting video game show. So we have different themes every show, but they're all nerdy themes, and they're all sort of, we're all sort of presenting with this very punk San Francisco energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a really great experience, and we're starting to, you know, work as a collective and like travel to different places. We want to work more conventions. We want to do Queen Kong at some point as a group. We want to do Mother, which Mother is a continuation of Tranny Shack.
So tell me more about this Pokemon show you had mentioned, because I love, like, I'm already in love with it.
Oh, yeah. So that was a really cool show. That was one of my favorites because that was our first one, and we had a lot of really interesting sort of confusion between the numbers this time around. So we were basically taking the audience through the Pokemon Tower at Lavender Town.
That's so cool.
Whoa.
And so one of us was Ghastly, one of us was Haunter, one of us was Gengar, and then I did the Marowak ghost. So the Marowak that you fight at the very end of that whole storyline in Red and Blue.
That's so cool.
Wow.
It's like a sad storyline, too.
It was really great, a great show, and it was such a relief when it all went okay, and you know how it is, I'm sure, like, you know, when you produce events. And so that was our first show, and then we've done a lot of other nerdy themes since then, but that was one of my favorites.
So what did your outfit look like as Marowak the ghost?
It was the same look that I wore to the FlameCon kickoff party.
Oh, cool. Wow. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Could you describe that for the listeners?
So I sort of made that look and that number with the intention of touring with it, because I've been wanting to do that for a long time, even before Dragula.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Now that you've mentioned Dragula a few times, do you mind just recapping maybe the most surprising thing that came out of doing the show?
I think the most surprising thing for sure was all of the extermination challenges that not only period, but that I did. I don't think anybody goes into that show saying, I want to do all the extermination challenges, just because they're horrifying, right?
It's like, right.
But I think, well, they definitely build character, I'll say that much. And that was really interesting. I don't think I could have really predicted that I would have had the narrative and the storyline that I ended up having. But I'm so proud that it was that way. I mean, I often kind of found myself at odds creatively with the Boulez. For my fans to see me stick to my guns was both like the most punk rock thing I could have done and also the most rewarding thing I could have done. Because now, you know, I've sort of melded, you know, everything that Dragula had to teach me with what I was already doing before the show, and now it's just sort of exploded into this whole other world of creativity. And so I such a successful experience for me.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about you wouldn't have expected the narrative, and it's so, like, we think of reality shows as reality, but they create stories in the edit room. So what was that like to, you know, experience the being in the show, you know, be doing the things, the shows and the making the costumes and whatnot, and then seeing the way it was edited together and having a maybe different narrative than you could have expected?
Well, you know, what was really nice about it was that we, or at least I did, I felt like we were all sort of, to varying extents, sure, but I felt like we were all in some way sort of steering and in control of our narrative on the show.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I never felt like anything was sort of exploitative or overly sort of sensationalized. It happened pretty similarly to how I remember it, or rather it was edited to be pretty much how I remembered it. It was interesting because I didn't want to overproduce myself, but I guess I just tried to be a more, you know, outgoing, maybe louder, realized version of myself.
Well, I feel like it's kind of rare, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's rare. And you know, I guess that what I was trying to say earlier was I wasn't overly producing myself, but I was sort of trying to be a more elevated version of myself so that I could just share what, you know, what I do and who I am with more people. So you know how to play things or how to complement sort of what's already sort of happening. So I think it was the right balance.
What is it like to then, you know, you've been performing for so many years at that point, doing this and growing your career and creating this character, then to watch a show about it and yourself in it? What is that like after so many years of you being the performer, you know, performing for other people?
It was mostly really, really good. There were moments when the whole experience really bummed me out, just based on negative feedback that I received or haters that I received. And I think at the same time, you're sort of watching yourself and you're just like, okay, how can I, even if I had a bad moment on the show or on camera, how can I turn that into a positive, you know? So I think that was sort of where my head was at the whole time was, you know, this is my shot to sort of take my career to the next level. I want to put my best foot forward. Like, how can I sort of just make the most of the experience and have fun with it, you know? I think that was the other thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take it too seriously because if you do, then you're just going to set yourself up for being sad all the time, you know? You have to learn to laugh at yourself and hear the things maybe you don't want to hear from people, even if they're hateful, you know? Having a thick skin is really important.
What did you learn about yourself from the experience?
Sometimes I maybe was not as insistent on a certain point of view as I could have been, or maybe I wasn't always the most sort of assertive or the most go get it in terms of, you know, doing things that were scary, you know, and that doesn't necessarily mean like needles are scary. It could just be, you know, having a difficult conversation with someone is scary, or being unapologetic about your opinion is kind of scary because you never know, you know, you're going to piss someone off. So I think going through all those exterminations, going through the competition itself, which is very, very, it weighs on you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I just feel a lot tougher and a lot more ready to just take on what's next.
What has been like the hardest part of this, you know, this career, this art of this journey?
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that's really hard that people don't realize is just the less glamorous side of doing what we do. You know, sometimes we're getting off the airplane and we're on very little sleep and we're trying to sort of make this fantasy come alive for people. Performing all the time, doing drag in general, it's very, very, very hard on the body. And I've had to learn, you know, doing this a lot more and touring a lot more, I've learned to, you know, have those sort of healthy habits for my body. But it's very challenging. It's very challenging. Injuries, just being tired, you know, your skin, your, you know, you sacrifice a lot. And especially the kind of drag that I do, the kind of drag that I always admire, it's highly transformative. So putting your body through all that on a regular basis can be challenging, but very much worth it.
How did you, I don't know why this popped into my head, but how did you develop your teeth when you're in drag? Like, did they change over time when you have the fangs?
That actually started because I was doing a makeup look inspired by a Pokemon that had very sharp teeth, which is called Bruxish. That was one of my most like well-received looks, I think, right before Dracula. So I had fangs custom done, and you know, when Dracula came around, I said, "Well, I've always been a fan of horror, but I've not always incorporated horror into my drag to the highest extent possible. You know, I had done a few of those kinds of looks, but well, what can I do in this promo shoot to sort of stand out?" And I thought, you know, those fangs are really beautiful, and now the fangs have become just a regular part of the gig. You know?
Yeah,
I'm a big signature of mine, specifically those sort of vampire fangs. I've always loved in like this sort of anime sort of Castlevania art style. Those just two vampire fangs have always really stood out to me. And I think those fangs first came from the Ghost Town Challenge. the wolf look, the skinwalker look that I did.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the first time that I remember wearing those, and I remember molding them to my teeth for that challenge. And then I just kept using them because they were just easy to pop in and out. They've just stuck.
You know, it's funny, you keep going back to Pokemon. What is it about Pokemon that so both touches you, I guess, and also you find so useful for drag?
You know, I don't know why it is that Pokemon in particular inspires me. I think maybe it was just my obsession with it as a kid. But like I said, I think there are a lot of people, cosplayers, cosplay drag queens, that do superhero characters, or they do human characters, humanoid characters. And I've always, like I said, been inspired by the non-human, sort of otherworldly. I think there's so much potential for like a clever adaptation when it's a non-human character, a non-human state. But like, how do you take that shape or that character and apply it to the human body in a creative way?
Yeah, that makes sense. So I also wanted to ask you, what are some other horror properties that you maybe loved when you were growing up or still creep you out today?
Well, yeah, you know, I have always, I grew up watching Godzilla.
Yeah.
the sort of Universal Studios horror movies. So I've always been a big time Godzilla nerd.
Yeah.
Jordan's obsessed with Godzilla.
I remember in high school, I went through a major immersion period with Dario Argento movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you don't know, he's an Italian horror film director. But his movies are very... They were horror drag before I knew that there was horror drag, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. It is so colorful and vibrant and violent violent also. But there's a beauty in the violence, and it's a sort of very stylized visual storytelling that really grabs me. And one of the projects that I'm working on, or that I've been working on, is a series of Dario Argento poster recreation. So taking all of the famous movie posters and sort of recreating them in some way.
Tell me about have you used Godzilla in drag?
Well, actually, for Pastel Gore, this last one, which is the fighting video game theme, I did Jet Jaguar from the Godzilla universe.
Nice.
I've done Mothra, and I'm waiting for the new Godzilla film in 2019 to come out before I start thinking about doing a King Ghidorah cosplay.
Wow.
Because that is high on my list.
Tell me, would you have three heads?
Of course, but I can't give away how I would do it.
Right.
How did the Mothra look? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this costumer in New York City called Whitney Newman, this is one of like her first ever commissions, but she made a set of Mothra wings for me. Ever since then, I've been, you know, doing that number. And so it's really, that's one of those situations where I take some of the color story that you see on Mothra's face, and sort of apply it in a very draggy feminine way.
Mm.
I think that look, it will continue to evolve over time, and it has definitely, because there are just always new ways to interpret Mothra's face onto my face. and I definitely want to bring that number on tour sometime soon.
Yeah.
Do you use any of the music from Mothra of the two twins?
Absolutely, and that's another thing that I love to do. I love to do mixes, whether that's a comedy mix or a sort of mix where you take the audience into the world of the source material. Just like I did with the Marowak number, you know, with the music and the, you know, from the original game.
Mm-hmm.
I like to do that a lot because, as I said, it just really immerses them in the world that you're trying to create. Yes, I did all the Mothra sound effects and the Mothra song is in there and you know, all of the sort of the greatest hits of, like, what you think of when you think of Mothra.
That's so cool. I can't wait to see the King Ghidorah one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did Mothra for Palso Gore, the Dance Dance Revolution one.
Okay.
That we did.
Cool.
So, yeah, I want to bring that number out again.
I want to see it.
Erica, if people want to get in touch with you online, where should they go?
Yeah, the best place for that would probably be Instagram. And that's Erica with a K, Clash with a K, all lowercase. Very simple. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook.
Cool. Do you sell merch online?
As far as merch, I sell T-shirts. I have a stock of T-shirts in my house that I ship out to people. But you can also buy them on Drag Queen Merch. And I sell prints as well. So when I'm touring, I always bring shirts. I always bring T-shirt prints. And if anybody wants to order a T-shirt or a print, they can just email me at ericaclash@gmail.com.
Emily, how do people get in touch with you?
Oh, on Twitter, I'm Emily G. Monster.
And on Twitter, I'm at Jordan Zacharin, and we also Phantom Files Sci-Fi. We're starting to tweet a little bit more.
Yeah.
And like, if you're listening on iTunes, look, you know what I'm going to say. You're going to, we need you to subscribe. We need you to give us 5 stars. Erica, could you tell them to give us 5 stars? Maybe they'll listen to you.
Give them 5 stars. If you love me.
Thank you. Thank you. If you love Erica Clash, you will give us 5 stars. We're putting on posters. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful having you on.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Erica.